All right, welcome back to another episode of the Sunstone Podcast. I'm your intrepid host, John Larson. I hope you guys are all surviving the apocalypse and the impending doom as Desnat is about to come and kick down our doors. Are you avoiding all of the extremists? Are you QAnon yet, Chris?
No, I have not been converted by the lizard people yet. So,
you know, it's simply not a John Larson podcast if we don't go straight for the worst part, like right out of the gate. You know, so I've got people like sharpening their swords at me. Well, I am so happy to be here tonight with my old friend Chris. Chris, how the hell are you?
I've been good, just holding up. You know, I mean, just surviving. What can you do? What more can you do in 2020 than just survive?
You survive. You watch a lot of Netflix. So, Dr. Chris Smith, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So you have a distinct honor. You were in one of the first 10 episodes, I think episode 4 or 5 of the original Mormon Expression series, no?
Yeah, was that Book of Abraham, I think we did?
That was the Book of Abraham. And long before we were ever recording those silly podcasts, you and I knew each other from the online world back arguing with the apologists.
Oh, yeah, we argued on those message boards so much. And the Book of Abraham was like the first topic that I got into at an academic level and published a few papers on.
Yes.
And it was just such a like nasty environment that I have migrated away from it. I've sort of sworn off doing anything with that.
Well, the minutiae, I mean, I didn't know it as well as you guys and some other people, but, and we're talking the early part of the 2000s. You know, the counting the folds on the documents and margins and just the people who know the Book of Abraham, it's spooky, scary, all the little details they have.
There is an insane amount of detail. I mean, those Egyptian alphabet and grammar documents, there's like 5 of them and they're multi-layered. And even to just describe to you the process by which they were created would be so complicated that I just was like, I despaired of even communicating it to anybody.
Right. And it's the whole Book of Abraham subcommunity. I don't care if you're ex-Mormon or Mormon. It's really like talking to like UFO people. Like, like you try to pin them down and they'll refer to this military document from 1977. You're like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Pretty much.
All right. Now you got your PhD a couple years ago. What is your degree in? What are you a doctor of, Chris?
I'm a doctor of religion. And I wrote my dissertation actually on Mormons and Indians, so relevant to what we're working on today, although I was working on the Utah period, not New York. So,
yes, and in interest of full disclosure, I've given a presentation on the Iroquois we're going to talk about a couple different times. And at Sunstone a few years ago, you were my respondent. So if people are really interested in this, you can go back and find Chris and I arguing about this 5 or 6 years ago, probably.
I don't think we did too much arguing, but certainly lots of agreeing.
Well, what is there to argue with? Yeah. I thought I'm always right, right?
It's pretty straightforward.
So one of the reasons that I've always really loved your opinion is you've never been a member of the church, no?
Yeah, that's right. I was raised evangelical, so came at this, I guess originally, I mean, it's not like I came at it objectively because I was out to convert Mormons in the beginning, but I have migrated away from evangelicalism as well. So now I guess I'm trying to be as objective as I can.
Yep.
As objective as anyone can when dealing with a religion that, you know, millions of people still adhere to.
And I'll say this, there's probably about 20 people in the Mormon studies world that are respected generally by both sides. And you, my friend, are one of those. And that is a hard place to be. Not very many people can accomplish it. And you've always been even keeled, and you've got great introspective. Of course, you're brilliant. In case you guys can't tell, I really want to go out on a date with Chris. I'm really trying to butter him up to that.
Oh, well, that's very sweet. So, I hope half of that is true.
So to level set, this is the first. I gave an introduction a few weeks or a month or so ago of a series that's been on my mind for a lot of years. I really wanted to go through and really look at the Book of Mormon very deeply. Like I said in the introduction, the Book of Mormon is problematic for Mormonism, and problematic just in the way it's approached, because it is so central to what it means to be Mormon. I think if you take away the Book of Mormon, you're left basically with kind of a more a less interesting evangelical movement. You know, because there's no songs and there's no snakes. I know that's not a. I'm just kidding about the snakes. That's not fair. Evangelicals, for the most part, don't use snakes. All right. So
the interesting ones do.
The interesting ones do. It's true. So our approach here is really to look at the Book of Mormon the way an outsider would, to try to kind of shed away that ex-Mormon bias that's just always trying to prove everything is false, and the Mormon bias trying to prove that it's true or it's divine, and really start trying to ask the question: what does the book say? What is it doing? What is the story that it's telling? So today I wanted to focus in on the kind of the place where Joseph Smith was up by the Finger Lakes, you know, in Palmyra, and what he had access to, and what would have influenced him potentially is thinking, and what does the Book of Mormon description of the Lamanites in particular say about who they are? I mean, archaeologically, we know a lot more about Mesoamerica and prehistoric, you know, the entire both continents. We know a lot more than we did in 1830. And having learned a lot of things and discovered a lot of things, putting that light on the Book of Mormon, what does it say? Now, we're going to talk about the Iroquois quite a bit and New York. We're not really getting into archaeology yet. That's going to be a future episode. But Chris, you're welcome to say whatever you want. Does that make sense to you? Is that convoluted? I know I oftentimes have ideas that make sense to me and nobody else.
No, I think it makes sense.
Okay. So, I mean, let's start at the beginning. Everyone gets kind of confused in when they're studying American history, because American history was rewritten by the New Englanders, because, you know, they had the schools and they wanted to kind of control the government and all that kind of stuff. And there was a lot that was going on before Plymouth Rock. A lot. And there was a lot of people here, and there was a lot of movement and trade. Of course, Columbus discovered the Americas in 1492. Did I get that one right?
Yeah.
And then after that, traders and trappers and sailors and explorers started coming to the Americas, and they were there for a long time. Now, of course, when you look at the names of these places when the initial, you know, after Plymouth Rock and some of the other settlers, they're always talking about these great big open fields. Of course, those fields were open because we decimated the native population with smallpox and other diseases, right? So even though when the first folks got there, there was a robust nations right on the coast, people who were building buildings and building with stone and trade networks and roads. There got to be kind of a mythos that all the Indians were Plains Indians and just kind of nomadic, in part because we'd killed them all.
Yeah, that's right. And also I would note that the Indians that the first settlers encountered were more forest dwellers really than plains dwellers, and so the Western stereotypes that we have today are really based on Plains Indians later developments. People in Joseph Smith's day thought of them as sons of the forest. They're always calling them sons of the forest,
right?
So they had kind of a different perception of Indians than I think we do today as well.
And part of that was driven, the first cash crop coming out of the United States was, of course, pelts, especially beaver pelts, because in the 1500s, in the 1600s, those hats, which I always, when I was a kid going to school, they'd always talk about beaver pelts and hats, and I imagine everybody in Europe wearing Davy Crockett hats, but that it's the top hats that you see. Those top hats were made of, the really expensive ones were made of beaver pelts, I guess because they shed water or they were really soft, I don't know. But the beaver pelts drove the fur trade. So in the 1500s and 1600s, you know, before the New Englanders were really setting up their religious colonies, there were a lot of trappers and trading posts, and we would have interacted with the Indians who were trading and trapping beaver for the Westerners. Am I off on any of this?
No, that's right. And in fact, unfortunately, one of the things that they kill the beaver so aggressively that they essentially wipe out the beaver in a lot of watersheds. And once you remove the beaver from a watershed, there's all kinds of other ecological consequences that sort of cascade from that. Yeah. And you can end up basically wiping out a lot of the game. And that's one of the reasons that native peoples who depended heavily on, you know, meat products for food often ended up starving as a result of all of this. They basically would, you know, starve because these ecosystems that they had depended on were destroyed because of the plundering of the beaver.
Yeah. So if, and that becomes important in some of the prejudices that, that get perpetrated even to today about Native Americans, is if you take a people and you destroy the ecosystem and you destroy their farming and push them out into the forest, they can't sustenance farm anymore. So the people become like refugees, and you get things like families that don't have a provider because, you know, people are sick or they're died, would go just camp outside of a fort, just like refugees do everywhere in the world. You know, if you burn down my house and you take everything away from me, and you kill my wife and half my kids, the rest of us are just going to wander to where there's safety, and that safety might be a fort. Unfortunately, there was this perpetual cycle of us damaging the ecosystem and the commerce and the economies of these native cultures, and then being prejudiced against those people because they didn't have commerce and cities and fields, even though they'd been taken from them forcibly or through circumstance.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is we have this stereotype of them as being incredibly low technology. But if you think about like the indigenous knowledge that they had about the plants and everything where they had lived for thousands of years, they, you know, could create fishing nets out of plants, and they could, you know, create fishing hooks, and they had all these sorts of like elaborate technologies that they had developed, but those technologies were very much suited to the environment. You know, they were specialists on how to use the plants and animals in a small area. And if you then remove them from that area and you move them to another location, then all of that specialized knowledge is suddenly useless in the new location.
For sure. And it's worse than that. But we would take that technology from them. You know, it's like you associate what peanuts with Thai food and potatoes with Ireland and tomatoes with Italy. Like those are all New World crops that were not in the New World. Sometimes they were kind of local equivalents, but they weren't in the New World till after Columbus, right? So we were very eager to learn these technologies from these folks. And then once we took them, then we would no longer see them as being, as you say, as being technologically savant. We would see them as being behind because, oh, we already know about tomatoes. But you know, if you're an itinerant people, you know, the Iroquois, they would stay put sort of, but they might have a fishing camp over here and a hunting camp over here and their winter village over here. But if you disrupt that, the place that they might grow their squash and their maize and stuff that they would go and plant in the spring and collect in the fall, there might be white settlers there now. So they don't have a lot of the input of what's coming along. Now, the reason I'm belaboring this point is the Book of Mormon is not kind to the Lamanites. It doesn't think very highly of them. It thinks they're lazy forest dwellers who can't really do anything. And that's why I'm belaboring this point, because this attitude about American Indians was very prevalent by the time Joseph Smith was around.
That's right. And one thing that you just mentioned that I really want to emphasize is that natives were horticulturalists, which means that they did some hunting, but they supplemented the hunting by growing crops, you know, squash, corn, whatever. By the time the white people are sort of filling in New York, settlers are filling in Palmyra, most of the natives are gone, and they have, the white people have developed this stereotype of natives as exclusively a hunting people. And really they heavily emphasize that natives are too lazy to farm. And that's why natives don't farm. Well, natives did farm, but white people essentially didn't know that or sort of erased that from the history, because they came in and drove the natives out. Away from their farms and took over their farms.
Yeah, and there was a whitewashing that went on, which is you would send the cavalry out to slaughter and drive the Indians out of their territory, and then you'd open the territory up for settlers. So it would be largely immigrants or, you know, individuals who are lower class, I'm talking economically, who are from the big cities say, oh, I can either work here in the sewers or I can go get new land out in the Ohio. So the people who were moving into the territory, which the Mormons did over and over again, Maine and that area where Joseph Smith was born up in Vermont would have been Indian territory, but it had been, completely conquered by the time Joseph Smith was born. And then they went out, into the Ohio and down into Independence and Nauvoo. These were all borderland places. And to be a borderland means 20 years ago you were Indian territory. It's not like the Indians were on that side of the river and we're on this side. No one was here. They had been forcibly removed.
Right.
Which, of course, to our point, leaves them as a disadvantaged and kind of broken people because you're taking away their cultural is everything.
Yep.
Okay, so let's mention the Beaver Wars. So they started arriving in America in the early 1500s, really, and they bring their smallpox and their other diseases with them. And what they do is they wipe out a lot of the Indian tribes that were on that coast, the ones who would have lived in Manhattan, the ones who would have lived in Boston. And for the Iroquois, one of their big competitive tribes were the Mohawks and the Mohicans, who were all the way up and heading over to the coast. The Iroquois were down below the Great Lakes, really in Palmyra, where Joseph Smith discovered the Book of Mormon, was right smack dab in the middle of the Five Nations. So as the Mohicans were conquered and the Iroquois lost their lost some of their big competitors around, they consolidated, and there were these five major tribes. Of course, there were more than that that became consolidated into a confederacy. And they were probably at their height, like really early in the 1600s, in the early 17th century. But and they became a war house, just because of their cultural cohesion and their ability to push back against the French, sometimes the British, other times. They were able to control that territory for a long time, but the beaver kept disappearing. And as the beaver became more and more scarce, the battles became more and more bloody, because that was the lifeblood of the economics of the New World, was that whole fur trade. So you can imagine, as that fur trade starts to collapse, things start getting a little bit more feisty. And really, almost the entirety of the 17th century is, till about 1760 or so, you have the Beaver Wars culminating in the French and Indian Wars, which was like 1750, 1760. And this leaves the Iroquois as a broken people, a people who were really, strong and had very good government and good governance and leadership. They could marshal armies to push back on the white settlers and whoever else was pushing in on them. But without the beaver kind of supplying their trade, they became more and more precarious.
Yeah, that's right. And one thing that I want to highlight here is that they had really a pretty high level of social organization. They had this confederacy, which essentially had a, formal bureaucracy, which was codified in a law. They had a guy named Dagon Wadiga, who was the great peacemaker, and he gave the great law of peace, and they wrote it on wampum belts and handed it down orally through oral tradition by the chiefs of the Great Council. I mean, this really was a pretty well-organized thing. It was not just some loose group of nomads that had no tribal organization. They had five nations, and eventually they added a sixth, the Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, Cayuga, Seneca, and the sixth was the Tuscarora, who were added later in the 18th century. And they built, they used the metaphor of a longhouse to describe their confederacy, because they built longhouses. Longhouses were how, like, the buildings that they lived in. And so we tend to think, and even, the Book of Mormon sort of reflects a view of natives as people who lived in tents. And that's sort of how we think of natives today, because we've got the, stereotype of people, nomads living in teepees. But the Iroquois were a more settled people, and they had these communal bark buildings. And a whole clan would live in the same longhouse. They were divided into different clans. you had your turtle clan and your wolf clan and so on. Each clan had like an animal totem, and they would live in these buildings. So it's, you know, we're going to talk about some ways in which the Book of Mormon reflects white stereotypes of natives, but it's also important to recognize the ways in which the Book of Mormon does not reflect, you know, sort of the social, the complex social reality of Iroquois life, because actually Iroquois life was a lot more complicated than the stereotypes.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because the stereotype that falls in the Book of Mormon is significant for what it says, but it's also significant, probably more so, for what's missing. And that's, you know, one of my chief complaints about the Book of Mormon is everybody is so flat. The characters are all without dimension. And part of that was, I think, Smith trying to put these things together. And you've hinted at one thing we're going to talk about here in a minute. The Iroquois built palisades. There are, if you imagine from like watching cowboy and Indian shows in the 50s, those forts that have the logs that go straight up in the air. So the way that the Iroquois build them is they build them round, and then they dig a big ditch around them. Well, we'll get to a description in the Book of Mormon where they describe those. But because of Smith's own prejudice, in my view, when they found these things that they didn't fit into their narrative of the Indians living in teepees and killing deer, they would assume that there had to have been another civilization. They would assume that the Indians couldn't possibly come up with this. You know, and there were like stone ruins around Joseph Smith's house. We'll talk about a couple of them. And the assumption was, well, brown people don't be these. There must have been some white people. There must have been an advanced civilization to do all these things, because of their own prejudice and own inability to assume that the Indians could have, in fact, created these things.
Yeah, that's right. And the irony is the Indians were still building those things in the time of Joseph Smith, when this mound builder myth was circulating.
Yes,
but
absolutely.
The white people just weren't willing to see it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Okay, so you know, we come into the Five Nations, and yeah, the Seneca and the Cayuga and the Onondaga and the Oneida, and then of course they up into the Mohawk. It was all the area right below Lake Ontario, where the Finger Lakes are, where they were kind of centered in that area. You know, there's an interesting, you have the Onondaga Indians, right? And there is an interesting quote that we're going to talk about. And this comes from the History of the Church. I am quoting from the 1976 edition, because, of course, the history of the church has been altered many, many, many times. This is from Volume 2, Chapter 5, page 79. Quote, "The brethren procured a shovel and a hoe and removed the earth to the depth of about 1 foot." And by the way, I should give some background. This is when they were heading out, when they formed Zion's camp, and they were heading out to go kick ass and take names in Independence. So as they're walking along, then this entry shows up. "The brethren procure a shovel and a hoe and remove the earth to the depth of about 1 foot, discovering the skeleton of a man almost entire, and between his ribs, the stone point of a Lamanitish arrow, which evidently produced his death. Elder Burr Riggs retains the arrow. The contemplation of the scenery around us produced peculiar sensations in our bosoms, and subsequently the vision of the past being opened to my understanding by the Spirit of the Almighty, I discovered the person whose skeleton was before us was a white Lamanite, a large, thick-set man and a man of God. His name was Zelph. He was a warrior and chieftain under the great prophet Onondagas, who was known from the Hill Cumorah, or East Sea, to the Rocky Mountains. The curse was taken from Zelph, or at least in part. One of his thigh bones was broken by a stone flung from a sling, while in battle years before his death. He was killed in battle by the arrow found among his ribs during the last great struggle of the Lamanites and Nephites." Now, I love this one. This is bantied about by Mormon critics all the time, partly because, and if you read entries from the journals of this time in the history of the church, this is what they do read like. They're very specific. You know, we're used to the church apologists now talking just in really super vagaries. But you know, there's identifying how the guy died, what he was like. These are his bones. But that word Onondagas, when you look at the map and realize that, you know, just five or 10 miles away from Joseph Smith's house was the site of the Onondaga Indians, it's kind of a hard coincidence to say, hey, that's not an influence. My point is Joseph had already kind of absorbed some of this Indian lore and was able to synthesize it into the narrative he was telling his believers.
Yeah, that's right. There was the Onondaga County, you know, so even if there were not a lot of Onondagas still there in the neighborhood, he still would have known that tribal name. And it's kind of interesting. Joseph Smith has this repeating pattern in Mormon scripture where he has eponymous founders. Eponymous means that a group is named after its founder. And so think of like Nephi founds the Nephites, Laman founds the Lamanites, Muluk founds the Mulekites, Zoram founds the Zoramites, Egyptus founds the Egyptians, you know, and yeah. I could go on. So to have an ancient prophet named Onondagas implies that he may be the eponymous founder of the Onondaga tribe. So Joseph Smith is creating what we call an etiological myth, a myth that explains the origin of something. And so he is, you know, creating this eponymous founder in order to explain where the Onondaga tribe came from.
Right. And Joseph Smith is really a master of the ellipses, just like Donald Trump is, that of taking his audience right up to the edge and not actually saying what's being implied, you know, and then individuals would have heard these names, and then there's the, here was this prophet, dot, dot, dot. And in their mind, they're like, oh, yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that name before. This must be something that's true, is how it kind of works.
Right. Had he spelled everything out, then it would look contrived, right? But because he leaves enough for you to draw a conclusion, like, oh, this must be where the Onondaga tribe came from, you then, in your mind, after making that connection, interpret that as evidence that his prophecy is true and legitimate.
Right. Now, if we go to the area where the Smith Farm and Hill Cumorah and stuff were, in walking distance are two big archaeological sites. There's actually a whole bunch of them up there. But the Seneca Castle and the Brighton Hill Tower of Peace, or the Boughton Hill Tower of Peace. So the point is these ruins are kind of still there or around to a degree when Smith and his family pushed into the area, there hadn't been white settlers in the area for a long time. So it would be very easy or not unheard of to be able to run into ruins from previous period and a lot of artifacts, a lot of iron artifacts, bronze artifacts, brass artifacts.
Yeah, so, you know, pre-Columbian natives obviously didn't have iron. They didn't have smelting technologies. But the Iroquois, after white people arrived, traded for various white goods, including things like iron swords and breastplates. And so you can find some of those artifacts in mounds. And of course, you know, people have always... There have always been hucksters and hoaxers who will dig up artifacts that aren't real artifacts as well. So, there were certainly rumors of things like swords and breastplates getting dug up in those mounds in New York. And that fed into this myth of an ancient mound builder civilization. And in some versions of this myth, there were white people and dark-skinned people, and they fought a great cataclysmic war in which the white people were exterminated. And this is part of the neighborhood, you know, part of the context that Joseph Smith grew up in. So that whole narrative of, you know, white people being exterminated by brown people or dark people is something that's a myth that already existed and was quite popular in Joseph Smith's neighborhood before he wrote the Book of Mormon.
For sure. And I want to belabor some of the points you just eloquently made. So when the Indians came in contact with particularly the Spanish explorers, these guys were coming in wearing breastplates, you know, mostly of bronze at the time or brass. And they had helmets and they had swords. And this was very, very common for the Indians to trade. And you referred to the mound builders. So this whole area, you know, all the way down into the Ohio, is sometimes referred to as the mound builder space because of a particular burial practice, which is that they would take their warriors and they would, you know, regale them in their armor, and they would bury them in these sacred hills. But the The issue is these hills had been burial sites for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So if you were an enterprising person with a shovel, you might dig down and run into one burial and then keep digging down and run into a second one and run into a third one. I was reading the book At Home by Bill Bryson. It's a great book. Bill Bryson's fun. And he's talking about the evolution of the home in Britain, in England. And he poses this question, you know, he said, why are all the churches, the English country parsonage churches, sinking into the ground? If you go by them, they all look like they're sinking. He said, they're not. They've been burying people around the churches for so long. And he says in the book, fact check it, that the average English parsonage has 40,000 bodies buried around it. You know, because people keep dying. So if you think about this tradition of burying your warriors in breastplates with swords, and you have an underlying prejudicial assumption that the Indians don't have breastplates and they don't have swords, you've got these big piles that seem like they're a whole bunch of warriors just buried, just mounded high. And if you're looking at it from a completely like folk, you know, a place of ignorance, of not asking what's actually going on here, you dig in there, the items that are going to remain are the bits of brass, the bits of steel, those are the things you're going to be able to find. And it would not have been uncommon to be able to rip these things out. Hell, the New Englanders, the Plymouth Rock folks bragged about digging up Indian burial sites to pull out the dried corn. They wrote about that openly. So like white settlers had no problem grave robbing the Indians. They didn't see it as any sort of desecration. And now you've got this story that you're trying, and you've hinted at it from before, that the mythos that there had been this great people here and these great battles wasn't something that Joseph Smith invented.
Yeah, and let me just give a couple examples of this mound builder myth in the 19th century, because I think it's significant to note who exactly was promoting this theory. One of the primary developers of this theory was Samuel Latham Mitchell, who, if you'll recall, you know, Joseph Smith copied some plates from the Book of Mormon and took the characters to Charles Anthon, very famously. Actually, Martin Harris took them to Charles Anthon and had Anthon try to translate them. He also, Martin Harris, went to a scholar named Samuel L. Mitchell, and Samuel L. Mitchell was one of the chief proponents of this mound builder myth. Samuel Mitchell had the idea that basically there had been three groups of emigrants to the Americas. There were Australasians, there were Scandinavians, and there were Tartars. So you've got white people in the Scandinavians, you've got some sort of Asian people in the Australasians, and then you've got the Tartars, who are like dark people from Asia. And his idea is that there was a protracted race war that climaxed with grand battles of extermination in upstate New York, and that the mounds were the relics of the extermination of the Malays and Scandinavians by the Tartars. And when Martin Harris takes these characters to Mitchell, Mitchell tells him that this is the writing of an extinct people. And it kind of sounds like Martin Harris may even have gotten kind of a recitation of Mitchell's theory from Mitchell. So, you know, it's fully possible that early in the process of translating the Book of Mormon, Martin Harris is directly told this theory by one of the very creators of this mound builder theory, you know, in which a dark-skinned people exterminates a light-skinned people. So,
and I want to emphasize that method that Joseph Smith used to acquire revelation. William McClellan, one of the early members of the 12, writes about it quite a bit, and you can actually see evidence of it in the history of the church. Sometimes what people would say is, hey, you know, Joseph, I was thinking about this thing, and it seems like it would be great if that's the way it would be. And then Joseph would come to the meeting the next day and he'd say, guess what, guys? God just appeared to me last night, and it's the way you said. And for the person who was suggesting what it was, that would have been hugely validating. The person you believe is talking to God just took your ideas to God, and they were given a stamp. So I want to try to explain that human psychology, saying why didn't they see what Joseph Smith was doing when he was just parroting back to them what they had just said? You know, like if Oliver had suggested something about the book or Martin, it's because they believed. They really did. They really believed Joseph Smith was divine. At least they did at first. And that was a powerful tool that Joseph kind of stumbled onto.
Yeah, and he was such a sponge. I mean, he would pick ideas up and they would stick in his head, and then you will find him months or even years later repeating the same idea. He just had an incredible memory, I think, for little weird details.
Prodigious. I mean, you know, there's talks of him, you know, talking for multiple languages, that it was clear he had almost encyclopedic knowledge of the Bible. Because extemporaneously he could quote, and we have many, many accounts where he could just go down the Bible. Now there's always and this is probably not appropriate for this podcast, there's always the question as why Joseph Smith never quoted the Book of Mormon. I think I know why, but he never really took to it, even after he translated it. It wasn't something he used very often. Okay, so let's go in and say, look, any other thoughts there, Chris, before we move on to what the Book of Mormon actually says?
Yeah, I'll just mention one more detail, which is that there was a guy named Josiah Priest who sort of developed this mound builder theory and elaborated on the idea of an ancient war of extermination. And he hypothesized that the white people had been so completely exterminated that only one member of that nation, a warrior, remained, which is kind of an interesting idea in light of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, for sure. And this is one of the reasons, you know, just to give a nod to Rod Meldrum and his ilk, the Heartland theory, they look at the same evidence that you and I are talking about, that where I suggest that it's a 19th century work, and they reject the Mesoamerica theory because they say, oh, there's too many parallels with North America. And I think they're right, but they're missing the bigger point.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So our first big description of the Lamanites occurs. Okay, now it's time to get out your scriptures, everybody. We're going to scripture chase a little bit. The first one appears in the Book of Enos, chapter 1, verse 20. Now, before that, we should give a nod to Laman and Lemuel are the older brothers of Joseph, Alvin and Hiram. No, wait, I'm getting all confused. Laman and Lemuel are the older brothers of Nephi, who is our intrepid hero of the book. And after they get to the New World, they rebel, and Laman and Lemuel run off into the woods. And by and by, their people, their descendants, their family, turn into the Lamanites. And this is the first kind of description of them that appears in the book in detail. Enos 1, verse 20. And I bear record that the people of Nephi did seek diligently to restore the Lamanites unto the true faith in God. But our labors were in vain. Their hatred was fixed, and they were led by their evil nature, that they became wild and ferocious, and a bloodthirsty people, full of idolatry and filthiness, feeding upon beasts of prey, dwelling in tents, and wandering about in the wilderness with a short skirt, skin, girdle about their loins, and their heads shaven. And their skill was in the bow and in the scimitar and the axe. And many of them did eat nothing save it was raw meat, and they were continually seeking to destroy us. Now, to the listener who's been paying attention, we've already hit on many of these themes of the way that white settlers viewed and described the Indians, that they were filthy, that they were living in the woods, that they were ferocious, they were angry, you know, but again, you have to understand that you're talking about a displaced people who had been warred upon for a long time. And some of the things are just not true. Like, we know that the white settler hygiene was shitty. It was really terrible. There's talk back and forth, you know, when white people meet indigenous tribes, they describe them as being dirty. And I think it's one of those things that, like, Donald Trump does all the time, like accuses everybody else of what they are. But this description really absolutely matches what the white frontiersman would describe the Indians as, being filthy. And I never noticed, I was reading it this time, but they don't just feed on beasts. They feed on beasts of prey, meaning you when you eat, you don't usually eat predators because they're stringy and they're not very good. Like, you don't eat bears and you don't eat cougars. You eat the prey. So they're throwing in a second insult. They don't even eat the deer. They eat the predators, you know.
And they don't even cook it. They eat it raw.
They don't even cook it. Yeah. Now let's talk about those web. Now, first of all, the head shaving, and I will put up on my website, johnlarson.org, pictures, paintings, both historical ones and contemporary ones that show what the Iroquois look like. Now this becomes important. The Iroquois did, especially the male warriors, did shave their heads. They either shaved them or they shaved them into mohawks or all sorts of crazy hairstyles. They look awesome. They're great. And they would use a red paint that they would oftentimes paint their eyes or parts of their face when they were going into battle. They also would, especially going into battle, they of course wore a loincloth. I mean, everybody wears an undergarment. So when they're going into battle, they might shed some of their other clothing. So the idea of a bare-chested Indian brave who's got his head shaved and his head painted red, walking around with an axe, a bow, or a scimitar, and we'll talk about the scimitar in a minute here, that is an absolute description of the Iroquois.
Right, and let me quote you one thing from Jonathan Trumbull, a contemporary source. He says of the Iroquois, their military appearance is very odd and terrible. They cut off all their hair except a spot on the crown of the head, and they paint themselves with a red pigment down to the eyebrows.
Yeah, and you can see paintings of them and pictures of them even today, and they look like they're ready to kick your ass. They would be scary going into battle with, right?
Yeah, yeah, and just to reiterate, I mean, this is a stereotyped description. This is obviously not how the Iroquois. This is not in any way a complete portrait of Iroquois culture, or even an accurate one. So.
It's good to bring back up because that's kind of the point we're driving at. Is if the Book of Mormon were to be able to give an accurate description of Iroquois culture, that would be a pause. That would be something we would say, whoa, where did they understand this? But that it reflects almost identically the prejudices of people who interacted with the Iroquois from the time is damning.
Right, right. Now, and I want to highlight one more thing here that didn't mention, which is it says that their hatred was fixed and they were led by their evil nature, that they became wild and ferocious and so forth. And it's interesting because Joseph Smith wrote at a time when the U.S. was sort of between two views of the Indian. Up until the 1820s, Northerners especially still had the view that Native people were the way they were mostly because of culture. These were not really racial characteristics. These were sort of cultural characteristics. And then from essentially 1830 onward, it becomes much more racialized and people increasingly are viewing these, character traits of like laziness and filthiness and ferocity as being intrinsic racial characteristics of the Indian race. And basically in 1830, Andrew Jackson passes his Indian Removal Bill, which basically rules that everybody all the Indians east of the Mississippi have to be forcibly removed to the west of the Mississippi. And that marks, I think, the end of an era when people were still hoping that Indians could be converted to Christianity and could be civilized. His view essentially is that, Indians are a lost cause and we basically just got to get them out of here. We're not going to assimilate them into our culture. We're just going to remove them across the Mississippi. I think that's a really important demarcation line because that was a big battle, actually. It was a big political battle where, Southerners especially were on the side of removing the Indians and saw the Indians as racially fixed, whereas a lot of Northern evangelicals saw this as a betrayal of the Christianizing and civilizing mission and the whole promise that we had made to Iroquois people, because actually a lot of Iroquois people and other, Northern and Southern Native tribes had adopted white lifestyles. They were living in, you know, American style houses. They had adopted Christianity. They had implemented democratic institutions. They were farming. They developed agriculture. And Andrew Jackson's Indian Removal Act forcibly removed them all anyway, even though they had done everything that we had asked of them and adopted all of the culture that we had asked them to adopt. You know, so I think it's important to note that the Book of Mormon sort of reflects both of these views. Mm. It's got the idea that natives can convert, which is very Northern, very Yankee, very sort of typical of Joseph Smith's neighborhood, that native, you know, race isn't fixed. But it's also got some of that racial language in there, that their hatred was fixed and they were led by their evil nature. So it's got a very mixed view on Indians. And I think that's very typical of the transitional moment that, you know, 1830 represents.
Absolutely. Fantastic point. All right, let's read a couple of the other descriptions as we're looking at their appearance, and we'll come into their weapons in a second. Alma chapter 3, verse 13. Now we returned again to the Amalekites, for they also had a mark set upon them. Yea, they set the mark upon themselves, yea, even a mark of red upon their foreheads. And then 3 Nephi 4:7. And it came to pass that they did come up to battle, and it was in the sixth month, and behold, great and terrible was the day that they did come up to battle. And they were girded about after the manner of robbers, and they had a lambskin about their loins, and they were dyed in blood, and their heads were shorn, and they had head plates upon them. And great and terrible was the appearance of the armies of because of their armor and because of their being dyed in blood. So you're again having that mark of red, but there's a point that I really want to bring up. The first description that I read you in the Book of Enos, that book occurs in the Book of Mormon about 400 BC or so. Then we have Omni, which occurs according to the succession around about 150 BC. So we're talking about 250, 300 years later. Third Nephi, is that, let's see, the third Nephi, let's see when they put that. This is about coming up between 50 and 300, 300 AD, right? And this is after, in the book, Jesus comes and sweeps the culture completely clean, and they say they have three entire generations of living righteously. What I want to point out is the Book of Mormon has these consistent descriptions that span 1,000 years, and the culture remains exactly the same. An anthropologist will tell you, like if we had a real anthropologist or an archaeologist who was expert in Iroquois burial sites, they would be able to pinpoint the site probably within 50 years based on what's in the grave, how they're wearing their clothing, and all that kind of stuff. The Book of Mormon attributes no progress, cultural or understanding, intellectual, anything, for a people for 1,000 years, even though that people was completely wiped out by Jesus and reinstated. There is no, I'm throwing down here, you cannot show me any culture in the history of the world that has that kind of cultural consistency over that period of time. And then when you add that on, that they're completely consistent with Joseph Smith's understanding of the Iroquois in 1830. So we're talking like a 2,200-year span where, according to Smith and the interpretation of the Book of Mormon, these people were living in the forest off of wild animal meat that they weren't cooking, and had no kind of culture for 2,200 years. It's just one of those things that bends the mind.
Yeah. I don't know what else to say about that. I guess what I'll say is that to their credit, there are some of the apologists, some believers in the Book of Mormon who basically think that the Nephites were racist, and they think that these incredibly stereotyped views of Lamanites are a reflection of the racism of the authors. And I think that's really the only way as a believer to make sense of this.
I agree with that. Okay, so let's talk about, and I'm going to, again, head out to my website, johnlarson.org, and I will put up some pictures of artistic representations, both contemporary and some from like the 19th century, that show Iroquois warriors and what they look like in their description. Now let's talk a little bit about what I've got titled here, Possession of the Land. Alma 53, verse 4. And he caused that they should build a breastwork of timbers upon the land bank of the ditch. Now, this is the describing in the book what the Nephites are doing to protect themselves from the Lamanites. So he should cause a breastwork of timbers upon the inner bank of a ditch, and then cast up dirt out of the ditch against the breastwork of timbers. And thus they did cause the Lamanites to labor until they encircled the city of Bountiful round about with a strong wall of timbers and earth to an exceeding height. And then Alma 49:18, now behold, the Lamanites could not get into the forts of security by any other way save by the entrance, because of the highness of the bank which had been thrown up, and the depth of the ditch which had been dug round about, save it were an entrance. When you head over to my website, or you could just Google it, you can type in Iroquois palisade, and you will see pictures of the way they built them. And they had their long houses in the middle. They would put the logs up, spike them at the top, and then they dig a big ditch around. So if you were trying to raid it, you'd have to go down into the ditch, climb up the dirt, and then you'd have these sheer walls. This thing was called a Mott and Bailey in Europe. It's a very common way to build the forts all over the world. But these were Iroquois forts. Now, as far as I know, and I've looked a little bit, there is no record that I've seen of these type of things being built in Mesoamerica. So again, you know, let's ask the question that we kind of framed here. Is it most likely that we're describing a way forts were built for thousands of years by the Nephites, and that somehow ended up in this Lamanite territory? Or we're describing the way the Iroquois actually built their forts, and that Joseph Smith is projecting that back into time. So that's the question.
I don't know about you, but I haven't left my house since March 14th. How did I do it, you ask? Well, after I ate everything in my freezer and then finished off the mustard, balsamic vinegar, and the horseradish packets from my fridge door, I dug into my food storage. The peaches were divine. The jalapenos were definitely worth the wait, and the pickled watermelon rinds from 1985 were so good that a couple of angels came and helped me eat some more after I finished my first bottle. Those are the blessings of food storage. And happily, Sunstone Magazine has been storing up plenty of Mormony goodness for you since 1975. I've been recording our best articles, both old and new, as audible quality podcasts, and posting them at patreon.com/sunstone. Head over and listen to a few of our free episodes, and then subscribe, and avail yourself of the decades worth of the best of Mormon thought and experience.
Okay, let's talk about possessing the land. 3 Nephi 4:1. And it came to pass that in the latter end of the 18th year, those armies of robbers had prepared for battle and began to come down and sally forth from the hills and out of the mountains in the wilderness and their strongholds and their secret places, and began to take possession of the lands, both which were in the land south and which were in the land north, and began to take possession of all the lands which had been deserted by the Nephites and the cities which had been left desolate. So this is something we were talking about right at the beginning. The idea that whatever ruins they were finding, the roads, the walls, the irrigation systems, those couldn't possibly be from these lazy, bloodthirsty Indians in the forest. It had to have been Indians that possessed and took over the land of the Nephites, which is a continuing theme in the Book of Mormon, that the Nephites build up civilization and then the Lamanites just steal it. And that's how they get it.
Yeah. And, you know, when you described to me what you wanted this episode to be, John, part of what you said was that you wanted to get an idea not only of, you know, how you would sort of debunk the Book of Mormon from the perspective of a critic, but also what would somebody who's an academic who's reading the Book of Mormon make of it, you know, with no interest in those internal disputes over whether the Book of Mormon is historical or not. And this is sort of what I do with that, is that when you read 19th century American myths about Indians, the subject of land is super, super important in all of those, because Americans, white Americans, are sort of constructing a national mythology that explains why they should have the right to the land and the Indians should not. And so you get a lot of like Tammany plays where Tammany is the last dying Indian, you know, the last survivor of his race. And he, with his dying breath, you know, makes the white people the heirs of his people's land. And you get, you know, the last of the Mohicans is a similar kind of thing where, you know, it's a myth of the fading of a native people and their replacement by white people. And native people are sort of made to authorize the white succession in the land. And so when you get a passage such as the one that you just quoted, where the Lamanites are coming in and sort of unjustly taking over the Nephites' land and their cities, that suggests that like their possession of the land is not really legitimate. And then you get all these passages in the Book of Mormon that suggest that the Gentiles, once the natives are converted, the natives are going to, you know, inherit the land, but the Gentiles are going to be co-heirs with them. The Gentiles are going to inherit the land with the natives. And so that really is Joseph Smith's version of a myth that explains why white people have a claim on the land. And note that in his version, it's not white Protestants who have a claim on the land. It's only the Gentiles who convert to the Mormon gospel. So it's white Mormons who have a claim on the land. So as kind of a bonus, he's, you know, not only authorizing white people to inherit the land, but he's making it just his followers.
Yeah, and there's another passage to underline what you're saying, 3 Nephi 4:5. And it came to pass in the 19th year, Gideonhi found that it was expedient that he should go up to battle against Nephites, for there was no way they could subsist save it were to plunder, rob, and murder. So I really like what you're saying, and I think it really places it as a 19th century justification. You know, the two original sins of the United States were the genocide of the Aboriginal Americans, the Indians, and slavery. And a lot of our historical myth has been trying to absolve us of those sins for 250 years or longer, and we haven't done it. And I like what you're saying, because it's a very 19th century idea that we can push the Indians off the land because they stole it from white people anyway. Right. And the white people are all dead and gone. But if you peel away that, then you read this passage that in the Book of Mormon, the Lamanites outnumber the Nephites. But it says there's no way they could subsist. They were to plunder, rob, and murder. But even after they wipe out the Nephites in like 400 AD, they obviously sustain themselves for another 1,400 years. It never really explains how you can have an advanced civilization with kings, because they have Lamanitish kings and Lamanite lands, and they can organize themselves into great armies, if all they do is just beat up people and kill them and eat them.
Right.
There's just a bridge missing there that you would, even if you were a faithful reader of the Book of Mormon, you'd have to say there is something missing from this book. And you hinted at that there are some apologists now who then say, well, the Book of Mormon is a flawed narrative from a flawed person that's giving a flawed view, which I can understand. But then you have to ask, well, why would God go through this? But there's one other point I want to bring up, and that it is a 19th century idea. This scripture is supposed to be ancient, from the period of 600 to BC to about 400 AD. If we compare this scripture to other scripture written in this time frame, there is no sort of like, the Babylonians don't have problems trying to justify the genocide of the Jews, right? It's not culturally an idea that would enter into their heads. It was, we are God's people and everyone else is our enemy and we're going to take them down. If this book were written, I don't think they would have the same sort of justifications if it were really written in that period. It would just be like, hey, we wiped out these people.
Yeah, I mean, you don't find a lot of like angst in the Book of Joshua or in, you know, when David goes and destroys the Amalekites, you don't have like a lot of hand wringing.
No, and I mean, the book, if you read the Bible, it's pretty clear that the land of inheritance was the land of the Philistines, right?
Yeah.
And they never struggle with that whatsoever. God just says, see this land where all the Philistines are, it's yours. And they're like, okay, let's go kill them. That's the book. And this sort of apologetic justification is more at home in the 19th century than in the 4th century.
Yeah, it definitely reflects a more modern sensibility in some of those ways.
Okay, let's talk about weapons. The Mormons always love the weapons. Alma 43, verse 18 through 20. And it came to pass that he met with Lamanites in the borders of Jershon, and his people were armed with swords and with scimitars and all manner of weapons of war. And when the armies of the Lamanites saw the people of Nephi, or that Moroni had prepared his people with breastplates and arm shields, yea, and also shields to defend their head, and they were dressed with thick clothing. Now the army of Zarahemla was not prepared with any such thing. They had only their swords and their scimitars, their bows and their arrows, their stones and their slings, and they were naked, save it were skin, which was girt about their loins. Yea, all were naked, save it was the Zoramites, the Amalekites. So here we hit that mythos again of if there's armor, they must be white. And again, swords, breastplates, everything they're describing, like even face plates and stuff, you can find Spanish versions of all of these things. But I want to focus in on the scimitar. That's one that a lot of people have spent a lot of ink on. I don't remember what the actual Iroquois name of this thing is, but they would carry, one of their favorite weapons was this club that they would carry. And it was oftentimes curved or angled, and they would sometimes put blades in it. So what is a scimitar? A scimitar is a curved sword that was made that way to make it easier if you were riding a horse to come down and like swoop and cut somebody severely, a mortal wound, without having the sword get knocked out of your hand. So it was curved that way for riding on a horse. So first of all, the description doesn't really make much sense of people like walking around with scimitars. I mean, people did, but that's not what it was primary for. But if you look at the archaeological pictures of these weapons that the Iroquois carried, they had a handle like a sword, they had a curved section like a scimitar, and they oftentimes had a blade in them. And Joseph could have very easily been exposed to them. It was a very common weapon for the Iroquois.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, a couple other things. We've already quoted passages where the Book of Mormon talks about bows and arrows, which of course is the standard stereotypical native weapon, and axes, which, you know, tomahawks are another sort of standard stereotypical weapon. And I think had Joseph Smith put tomahawk, the word tomahawk, in the Book of Mormon, it would have been too much of a giveaway. But he's, you know, he's going for the stereotype enough that he uses the word axe quite often in relation to Lamanites.
Now, when I was studying for this years ago, I have a vague memory of that axe heads themselves were a big trade item because they were made of iron. And you know, they wouldn't bother putting the handles, so anybody could put a handle on one, and they lasted for a long time. So they became family heirlooms. They could be sharpened. They had a lot of utility. And so, as you point out, it's just, if you asked an average American about their stereotypes of Indians, there's a tomahawk, there's a hatchet. And so it's not that strange that this shows up because it was such an element of the Indian trade.
Absolutely.
Scalping, Alma 43. And now when Moroni had said these words, Zarahemla retained his sword, and he was angry with Moroni, and he rushed forward that he might slay Moroni. But as he raised his sword, behold, one of Moroni's soldiers smote it even to the earth, and it broke by the hilt. And he also smote Zarahemla, that he took off his scalp, and it fell to the earth. And Zarahemla withdrew from before them into the midst of his soldiers. And it came to pass, the soldiers who stood by, who smote off the scalp of Zarahemla, took up the scalp from off the ground off the ground by the hair, and laid it upon the point of the sword, and stretched it forth unto them, saying to them with a loud voice, "Even as this scalp has fallen to the earth, which is the scalp of your chief, so shall ye fall to the earth, except ye will deliver up your weapons of war and depart with a covenant of peace." It's not the only reference to scalping in the Book of Mormon, but scalping is this interesting thing. First of all, it's not that easy to do. You have to kind of like work at it a little bit. It's like skinning an animal. Secondly, it's the Europeans who introduced the concept of scalping to the natives. Not that they couldn't have figured it out themselves, but it's because the Europeans paid bounty. The biggest example is during the French Indian War. The French would pay, well, the Iroquois, for scalps of English, because then they, because if you had a scalp of the person, you didn't have to have a body, but you knew there was a kill. So scalping was not uncommon on the frontier, but as far as I know, there is no reference to scalping anywhere in Mesoamerica.
Yeah, I don't think that it was practiced in Mesoamerica. I will say that it's controversial whether the white people introduced it to the natives or whether it was already here before the white people came and the white people just adopted it. So I'm not 100% certain that the white people, you know, introduced it, but it does seem to have been a feature of, you know, North American Indians, not Mesoamerican Indians. And it's also interesting. I mean, there's several components here. Not only do they smite off the scalp, but they also display the scalp in order to cow the Lamanites into making a peace treaty, which is, you know, that's how scalping was used, is you would display the scalps in order to intimidate your enemies. And not only were Indians using scalping in North America in the, 18th, 17th and 18th centuries, but white people were also scalping Indians the other way around, and using that to intimidate Indians into making peace as well. So I would say this is probably an etiological myth that, mm-hmm. as I mentioned earlier, etiological myths are myths that are designed to explain something, explain the origin of something. So this is a myth that's designed to explain the origin of scalping. This is the first scalping in Indian history in Joseph Smith's mind.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I agree with everything you're saying. And this does tie back to what we were saying at kind of at the beginning of the thesis. The fact that scalping figures so prominently in the book places it 19th century, 18th century. Because, you know, if you were to write a book about Indians today, like just based on what you know, scalping would probably not be a prevalent part of the book. And if you were writing one in 1502 or whatever, it probably wouldn't be there. So it's another indicator that this is most likely 19th century work.
Yeah, 19th century New York work, no less.
Yes. Okay, we got two more things we kind of want to cover. Rating for women is the second to last one. Mosiah chapter 20, and having tarried in the wilderness and having discovered the daughters of Lamanites, they laid and watched them. And when they were there, but for a few of them gathered together to dance, they came forth out of their secret place and took them and carried them into the wilderness. Yea, 20 and four of the daughters of Lamanites they carried into the wilderness. Again, you've got these ne'er-do-well sort of Nephites who are spying on, first of all, the pretty young Indians who are dancing in the forest. Right. And then they carry them off into the wilderness. Of course, the idea of Indian raids for women was a huge part of the 18th, 19th century mythos of Indians. They were commonly that's they would go into cities all the time and say, they're going to come steal all your women. Right. And it's just an idea that very much describes the prejudices of settlers at the time against Indians that shows up right here in the book.
Yeah, there was a whole genre of 19th century literature called the captivity narrative, in which basically, you know, a woman would describe in very dramatic fashion how she was kidnapped by natives and usually raped and then made to join their culture as a wife and bear children and whatever. It was a very melodramatic genre of literature, very popular, and there are hundreds of examples of these captivity narratives. And so I think that this reflects sort of the popularity of that genre.
It does. But let's also be clear. It was a practice of the Iroquois to raid for women.
Right.
The Iroquois have an interesting governance. I wish we had another 6 hours to go into it. They have kind of a split power structure between men and women. For example, the chiefs were all men, but the chiefs were appointed by the women, who could get rid of any of the chiefs at any point. So it might be Chief Bruce, but if all the women didn't like the way Chief Bruce, they would just fire him. The men were all the warriors, but only women could declare war for the Iroquois. And it wasn't uncommon for them to raid villages and take stores and take people back with them. And the Iroquois practiced a small form of slavery that was really common. But most often, if you were a young woman, you were 15 years old, you were raided, and then somebody came back 5 or 6 years later, they would find you as a full member of that tribe. So it's true, and we don't have time to go into it. It's true that the Iroquois and the Indians at the time raided villages and even white settlements and took women. One of the dark secrets of American history they ever tell you, it's really fascinating. I should find a book that I can reference you to. They talk about how white women would get taken by the Indians, and then the white settlers would go try to get them back, and they'd always refuse to go. They liked living with the Indians more than they liked living in the colonies.
Right.
So this is a double point. It reflects prejudices and narrative at the time, but it's also based in practices that were indigenous to the Iroquois.
Yeah, there's a historian named James Axtell who wrote a great article about that, about how, you know, that very few of the Indians actually converted to white culture because when they tried, the prejudices against them were so great that they couldn't be accepted into white culture even if they did everything right. Whereas when these captives, white captives, were taken back to Iroquois communities, you know, they were embraced as full members. And the Iroquois had a whole ritual process of integrating these people into the community. And this is a way that the Iroquois maintained their population in the midst of disease and warfare, is that they would go out and take captives and they would integrate them into their community. And that's part of what made the Iroquois so powerful, is that they were so good at doing this, at taking captives and integrating them. So
for sure. And then the last, I promise, the last scripture I'll regale you with tonight, Alma 28:11, and the bodies of many thousands are laid low in the earth, while the bodies of many thousands are moldering in heaps upon the face of the earth. Yea, and many thousands are mourning for the loss of their kindred, because they have reason to fear, according to the promise of the Lord, that they are consigned to a state of endless woe. The end of the Book of Mormon, of course, ends with these great big epic battles around Hill Cumorah that have been, you know, put into pageants and put into pictures and put into stories, that there were so many dead that all they could do is pile them up. And we've talked about the mound builders a lot, but this is that appears in the book, where it's kind of in my interpretation, a layman's view of where all these big hills came from. And, you know, you had these drumlins, these hills that were formed by the glaciers. And during the last big ice age, as they receded up north into Canada, into Antarctica, or into the Arctic, I should say, they left these hills that were formed by the debris deposited. And they're kind of strange because they look almost like they don't belong there. They look almost like you have a flat prairie, and then all these hills are kind of aligned north south in a way that looks a little bit weird. And then you dig into them, they were soft earth, and because that's what the natives would use to start burying their dead as the mound builders. So it was something that you could extrapolate the story of this battle that was the largest epic battle, because where did all these people come from? Again, a point we already made, but I wanted to make clear that it is in the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, let me quote one scripture at you, John. There's in Alma 18, there's this interesting exchange between Ammon and the people of Lamoni, who are Lamanites. And he says that the Lamanites believed in a great spirit. And he has this conversation with them where he says, "Believest thou that there is a God?" And he answered and said unto him, "I do not know what that meaneth." And then Ammon said, "Believest thou that there is a great spirit?" And he said, "Yea." And Ammon said, "This is God." And Ammon, you know, then goes on to explain the concept of heaven to him and other things. And you can find all sorts of accounts of missionaries going to Native Americans and having similar kinds of conversations with Native Americans, because Native Americans, of course, didn't have the categories of God and heaven and so forth that white people brought with them from Europe. So I think that this is basically modeled on sort of your standard missionary narrative.
Right. Well, and kind of a prejudicial view of a communication style of Indians. You almost expect them to say how,
right,
or ug or something.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It's very stereotyped.
Well, okay, we've kind of gone through it. Of course, there's more stuff in the Book of Mormon. I'll leave it as a homework assignment for you guys to all read the Book of Mormon. But, you know, you're left to ask a question. Here is this book that was started by Jews who escaped Jerusalem in 600 BC, came to America, split their culture, and had this thousand-year run. And it just so happens that every physical description of the Indians matches almost completely, almost identically, with the Indians who Joseph Smith had moved into their backyard. from an outside perspective, the probability that that they could get all of these things to match up exactly when there is nothing gained by them matching up. It doesn't make any point. It doesn't lend to the credence of the book. It doesn't help the narrative of the Book of Mormon. It doesn't help the narrative that this is a book that was written for our day. It doesn't help introduce any doctrines, any new Mormon doctrines. If you think about everything that's Mormon, that defines it as unique faith, none of it comes from the description of the Lamanites. The Lamanites really serve not much of any function, and when they have, like I'm thinking of Spencer Kimball, you know, talking about that they're coming to God, and the Navajo and the Hopi and the Zuni are starting to turn white. That's just an embarrassment for the church today. So not only do you have this highly improbable circumstance that, as far as we have been able to discover, has never happened, it serves no purpose, and it in fact detracts from the narrative of Mormonism to begin with. From an outside perspective, that stuff lines up to say it's really, 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 really super unlikely that, just given these things, that the Indians from wherever these would be either had that kind of consistency over thousands of years, or that Joseph Smith was able to describe them perfectly in a way that perfectly describes the Indians that are living next door to him also.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly made a forceful case for the Book of Mormon being 19th century. For me, because it's sort of a given that the Book of Mormon is 19th century, I don't feel the need to make that strong a case, but I do think that the Book of Mormon is a really interesting representation of sort of 19th century, like, romantic white racial nationalism. And so I think that it's interesting in that light to look at as kind of a relic of a certain kind of racial nationalism that existed at that time.
I think it's a brilliant point, Chris. And I think that the shame is not that Mormonism is not studied. It's studied in the wrong way. Like I teed up at the beginning, usually either Mormons trying to prove it or ex-Mormons trying to disprove it. But I do think, you know, to understand even what's going on today in 2020 with white nationalism and white identity and white Christianity mixed with violence, you could probably gain more from reading the Book of Mormon, trying to understand the movements of what's going on today with the Proud Boys and with Christian evangelicals. You could gain more than trying to understand Mesoamerica or Judaism or Christianity by reading the Book of Mormon.
Yeah. I certainly wouldn't want people to come away from this podcast feeling like the Book of Mormon isn't interesting or that it's not useful to study. I just think that you have to study it as something other than a, you know, a Mesoamerican text.
Excellent point. I mean, this book and these passages, they're not just completely throwaway. The fact is Joseph and crew came up with this book either on his own or with a little bit of help. It kind of, to me, doesn't matter. But the book exists, and the book is interesting for what it is. And I think that's the point, and this is a good place to leave us off. That's the point I want to make in the upcoming episodes. Let's look at these things for what they actually are, what they actually say, instead of either putting these narratives of true and false around them. They're not useful.
Yeah. Agreed.
Chris, it's been a pleasure. Where folks who want to read more of your stuff or where's your web presence? Where can they find you?
Well, I've got a website, Christopher Carroll Smith. Carroll has two R's and two L's. And they can, you know, just click over to my curriculum vitae page, and I've got all my publications listed right there.
And since this is the Sunstone podcast, give a shout out to Sunstone. You do participate in the history podcast from time to time. Am I right?
Yeah, the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast. And I believe that we're in the process right now of creating season 2. So should be coming soon.
Well, Chris, next time you're around in Utah and we're not in the apocalypse, let me buy you a drink.
Sounds good. I'd love it.
All right. Thanks, brother. We'll talk again soon.
Okay. Thank you.
And thanks for all of you. We'll be posting more episodes soon. Please, if you have feedback or comments, or you feel like you have an area of expertise that you'd like to help out with, please email me at john@johnlarson.org or johnlarson@sunstone.org. They both work. There are some of you who've reached out to me that I have not answered yet. That's because I do a lot of things other than this, and I'm kind of lazy sometimes, but I will eventually answer every email. Please don't fret if I don't get to it right away. Head over to Sunstone, find the artist, musician, restaurant, nonprofit that you believe in and throw them some money. Everyone needs it right now. Thanks, everyone. Have a great night.